How many of you have ever had trouble with teenage kids? Let's see our hands. The rest of you are liars. Or you don't have them. You don't have children. That's what it is. You don't have teenage children. Because if I hear this right, and having raised teenage children myself now, oh my, it happens, doesn't it? It comes along. You know who the culprits are? It's the opposite sex. When boys get into girls' lives, oh, it's something. Well, I'm glad that you were honest with me about that, because I tend to agree that in the course of life, that as children grow up and we as parents try to do our best with our children, that we're going to run into some problems along the way. You've already confirmed that. I'd like to share with you a bit of wisdom that came from under the sun when I was a ministerial trainee. It helped me face my real first crisis with my oldest daughter, who's now in Texas A&M. The advice developed like this. I was talking to a minister. I happened to be the ministerial trainee. I think I was an elder at the time. And this gentleman that I worked for was having trouble with his son. And he was a nice young man. It was just he was growing up and he was having trouble with his son. So I remember talking to him one day and I said, listen, I said, what are you going to do? And he says, I haven't figured out. And I said, okay. And he talked to me about it. And he said, now this is what I'm doing. And I don't really remember what it was that his son had done. He wasn't quite into his teenage years, but he was close. But he was in pretty big trouble. And his father told me that he told him, now listen, there's not a thought that you've ever thought that I haven't already thought. And there's not a thing that you have ever done that I haven't already done. So whatever you're thinking and whatever you're wanting to do, I've already thought it and done it, so don't do it. I thought that sounded pretty good. I mean, that went right into my thinking cap, and it stayed there for years until I had my first crisis with my now oldest daughter. So I thought, well, it was good enough for him. It's good enough for me. So I ushered my daughter into the back room, and I set her down there, and I was talking to her, and guess what I told her? I said, Tanya, you have never thought a thought that I have not thought, nor have you ever wanted to do anything that I have not wanted to do or done myself. She looked at me and she said, okay. And I said, are you going to think about that? She said, yeah, I'll think about it. So she went back to her room and she went in there, and about a half hour later she came out and she said, Dad, she said, I've never been in this much trouble in my whole life, so whatever it is that you want, I'll give it to you. She said, whatever's wrong. And I thought, well, that did pretty well. So then when my second daughter came along, and it was interestingly enough about the same age, about age 14, that's when it got a little bit troublesome. So I ushered Talia into the back room, and I gave her the same speech. I said the same thing. I said, I don't know what you're thinking, but whatever it is, I thought it, and I don't know what you're wanting to do, but whatever you're wanting to do, I've already done it. And I thought about that speech afterwards. It's the second time I'd used it. And I didn't know what, I thought, here Talia is going to go back and think about that, as Tanya did, and I'm wondering, what do you think about Dad? That Dad has thought every thought that they have thought. And I don't know whether it worked or not, but I thought it was rather foolish on my part in a way, although it did get across a point to them, and it was educational. I wonder if I've thought every thought that my daughter's thought. No. I don't believe I have. I've never been in love with a boy. So I haven't done that. So I'm not going to use that anymore. I'm through with that line of reasoning. I mean, there's an element of truth to it, but I'm through with that one. I'll have to go on to something else. Now, the reason why I'm telling you this is because the Bible tells us that someone preceded us by many, 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 many years, and he used the same line of reasoning that I just talked to you about. Only thing, he worded it a little bit differently. And I'd like you to share that with me. I want you to turn back to the book of Ecclesiastes, where perhaps you have made your journey through the Feast of Tabernacles. And I want you to see what a very wise man had to say to all of us. And I want you to notice the language that he uses, and I want you to sense his frustration. And perhaps by the time we work our way gingerly through all of this, we'll all be a little bit wiser along the way. This is over in Ecclesiastes, and I want you to notice with me over in chapter 1. Let's see what this wise man had to say, because he had a great deal to say. Notice, if you will, up in verse 10. I'd like to begin there. And appropriately so, it says, "Is there anything whereof it may be said, see, this is new? It has been already of old time, which was before us." And we've heard that expression, "There is nothing new under the sun." Now, notice, if you will, if you'll jump back up with me now to verse 8. Solomon said, "All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it." And this is important. "The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." And that is so true. Have you ever wanted to really do something? I mean, it was just something that was inside of you, deeply was inside of you. You wanted to, let's say you wanted to go someplace. Let's say you wanted to go to Jamaica. I'm going to use that for an illustration. Has anybody here ever been to Jamaica? Can I see your hands? Okay, good, good. How many of you want to go to Jamaica? What if we pay your way to Jamaica? Now, I'm using this for a reason, because there's an expression that Solomon is going to use here that becomes important to us. I'm going to come back to this Jamaica thought. It says here in the book of Ecclesiastes, over here in verse 1, as we work our way through here. In verse 9, it says, "The thing that has been, it is that which shall be, and that which is done is that which shall be done. And," it says, "there is nothing new under the sun." There's that expression I want to focus on. If you were to take your Bible and begin right now, just casually to sit down and read through the book of Ecclesiastes, it would take you probably about 40 minutes. In the course of reading the book of Ecclesiastes, you're going to come across this expression, "under the sun," 29 times. 29 times "under the sun" is used. It is often or frequently followed by another expression which Solomon uses, and you find it mentioned in verse 2 of this chapter 1, where it says, "Vanity of vanity, saith the preacher, vanity of vanity, vanity, all is vanity." What do you think he meant by that? Sort of a sense of futility, but he meant something else by it too, and I'm going to bring it right up to date. And what that means is this. Those of you who have been to Jamaica, I saw your hands. I have been to Jamaica as well. What do you think that Solomon would say to all of us that have been to Jamaica if he were here? What we all do with each other. Who all has been to Jamaica? May I see your hands again? Okay, there you are. I want to tell you something. I've been there and I've done that. I've been there and I've done that. Okay, I think Solomon could say that. How many of you want to have a big home? I'm going to talk about that in a moment. What do you think Solomon would say about that? He'd say, "I've been there and I've done that." Wouldn't he? Vanity of vanities, all is vanity, he would say. I've been there and I've done that. How many of you have been to Panama City Beach? Wait a minute. I've been there and I've done that. And I'll be honest with you about it. I've been there and I've done that so much that I'm beached out. I'm really, truly beached out. I didn't used to be. As a youngster, I guess, I really liked the beach. But I'm beached out now. Now, I want to go to Panama City Beach, but I want to go for a different reason than I used to want to go. See, I used to want to go for different reasons. Now I want to go just to be with God's people. I used to want to go because of the beach and the sand and all this kind of thing. And, oh, it's so much fun to roll around in the sand, isn't it? Oh, I mean, I used to watch these commercials on TV. They just tickle me to death because I've been there and I've done that. Here were these commercials on TV, and they showed this couple in swimsuit material. And they're involved with each other on the beach, rolling around on the sand. And that's supposed to make us want to buy that product. Have any of you ever been there and done that? rolled around with your loved one on the beach in the sand? Have you ever done that? Some of you have been there and done that. I'll be honest with you. I've been there and I've done that. And because I've been there and done that, I don't want to do it anymore. If you want to do it, I'll tell you what to do. Go home after the feast, buy yourself a 6 foot long, 3 foot wide piece of sandpaper and roll on it. I've been there and I've done that. Not the sandpaper. I haven't done the sandpaper. The other thing. See, and I'm reading through this book and I'm trying to get updated like Solomon would have me to do it, and because he does it for me, but you know, sometimes it's tough to really believe him, isn't it? It's really tough. Now I want you to see what he tells us here is vanity and all is vanity, and he's been there and he's done that. Might I just have the wisdom to learn from him? Now notice what he says over in chapter 2. We'll skip through some verses here. Here's what he says in verse 3, chapter 2. He says, I sought in mine heart to give myself unto wine, yet acquainting my heart with wisdom, and to lay hold on folly till I might see what was that good for the sons of men, which they should do, here's another expression, under the heaven all the days of their life. A point I'm going to make with you early on is that we can and choose to live under the sun. God doesn't want us to make that our choice. He wants us to live above the sun. There is a difference, and I'll illustrate that to you. But he says here, I wanted to sort of see what it was all like. What are they doing here under the heaven all the days of their life? Here's what he did. He said, I made me great works, and I builded me houses. When I was younger, guess what I wanted? When I used to live in a one-bedroom apartment in Saginaw, Michigan, guess what I wanted? You know what it's all about, don't you? I wanted a bigger place. I mean, two-bedroom. You get a two-bedroom, guess what you want? You want a three-bedroom house. Okay. And then you want a bigger place, and you want a bigger place, and you want a bigger place, and now I've got a place that's about 1,800 square feet. You know what I want now? You guys are pretty smart. You've been there and you've done that. That's why. You've been there and you've done that. That's exactly right. It's too much work. You know what I want now? I want to move in with you. But why won't I do that? Because I've been there and I've done that and it doesn't work. Okay. But why didn't somebody tell me way back when? Why is it that when I was a youngster, maybe they did. Maybe they did. Now, I can illustrate it to our young people, for example. Maybe I should read on just a little bit farther because Solomon brings it out so beautifully here. You get the point about the house, don't you? I mean, you know, there's no end to it. You want a big house? Solomon, if you want a great big house and a big mansion, you know what Solomon would tell you? I've been there. I've done that. It's all vanity, all vexation of the spirit. It's not where it's at, as they say today. That's living under the sun. He goes on to say this, I planted me vineyards. Any of you ever planted vineyards? How many in here have vineyards? Ah, they're hardworking people. Any of you have fruit trees in the back? Ah, so you're sort of working up to it, all right? Everybody wants to have a fruit tree in the back, correct? Isn't that sort of a biblical, millennial desire? Sure, it's great. Just do it. I've been there. I've done that. I don't want to do it anymore. You know why? It's too much work. And I can't beat the bugs. I've got these little peaches that come out of my tree, and I watch them. But some of the bugs get them before I do, and I don't spray insecticides or anything else like that. It just sort of frustrates me. You know, I've got these big old apple tree and a pear tree out there, and these big old huge bumblebees about this big seem to get them before I do. So I understand this, but not like some of you do. But the Song of Solomon, or excuse me, the Book of Ecclesiastes written by Solomon, he would tell you that he's been there and he's done that. Now let's look at some of the other things he says here. So I made me gardens and orchards, and I planted trees in them of all kinds of fruits. And I made me pools of water. Any of you ever want to have a fountain? Fountains are nice. Aren't fountains nice? Someone gave me a fountain. I thought it was wonderful. What it is, it's a big clay vase bottom, and inside of it's a recirculating pump, and there's a little hose that comes out the backside, and it comes up on a stand, and there's another smaller pot up here, and then in that, the water spills in here and spills down in here. You've seen them? It's great, isn't it? I always wanted a fountain. I had it for about 2 weeks, and it quit. And then it got into cold weather, and I had to worry about the water freezing in the vase and running all over the place. And I've gotten down there, and I've worked with it, and I've gotten the screwdrivers, and I've pried things apart, and I looked at all the electrical wiring, because I want that fountain to work, because I want a fountain. I can't get it to work. Now it's frustrating to me. I've been there, and I've done that. I don't want a fountain anymore. If you, any of you want a fountain that doesn't work, see me after church. Oh, it almost tires me out to think about all that. Look what else he says. I got me servants and maidens. Any of you done that? Don't show hands. Song of Solomon, he had all the maidens he wanted, didn't he? Come on, think about it for a moment. Everybody looks around, not everybody, a lot of people say, well, boy, you know, if I could just trade in a younger one for this old one I've got. You know, Solomon would say what? What would he say to you who have that desire? What would he say? He'd say, I've been there. I've done that. Wouldn't he? How many times did he do it? Oh, not just once. Not just twice. Come on, get the picture with me. Oh, there's a good one over there. I like that one. That one's blonde-headed, about 6'1". Yeah, I'll take her. Well, I don't know. Let's try that brunette over there. I want that brunette. Now, she's 5'2", weighs 200. There's nothing wrong with that. And then he goes over here and he wants redheaded, and he wants, you know, he wants all these, wants the different skills. By the time it's all done, he's got how many women? 1,000. Come on, man, think about that for a moment. All right, come on. So when you think about wanting to have another woman, what would Solomon tell you? Stay single. No, he wouldn't say that. He'd say, I've been there. I've done that. And then you know what his advice was later on? I'll show it to you. What was his advice? I'll give it to you a little bit ahead of time. What was it when he had all these women? What did he really boil it down to? After it was all said and done, he said, you live with the wife, singular, of your youth. Never noticed that in there? But I got to thinking about this, and I want to change it just a little bit, because we always look at it from that point of view. Now, ladies, look at that good-looking guy sitting next to you. You want 1,000 of him? We'll have divorce counseling after church. I mean, okay, 1,000 is too... I mean, 1,000, that's the attendance today. I mean, that, look around, ladies. I mean, just imagine in this room, all these seats... Here you are. You come up on the stage and you look out there and you're 1,000 men just like your husband. It's enough to depress you, isn't it? So Solomon says to you ladies, says to you men, listen, I've been there. I've done that. Listen to me, he says. Okay. But we don't. He also says, I gather me also silver and gold.
and the peculiar treasures of kings and of the provinces. You know, young people have peculiar treasures. I relate this to my family a little bit, because when you become a certain age, I was talking to you about teenagers, what is an item that every teenager has to have when they get to be about 16 to 18, they think? Oh, so you've been there and you've done that. Okay. Well, I hadn't been there and done that until a couple years ago. And one of the reasons why I hadn't been there and done that, because I didn't want my daughter to have an accident. You know what she told me? She said, "Oh, Daddy, don't worry." She said, "I'll be a great driver. I'll be a safe driver. I won't dare have an accident in the car." And I said, and I was gullible, I said, "Oh, really?" And she said, "No, Daddy, I'll be safe." You know what happened about a month after she had the car? By the way, I didn't buy her a car. I let her use mine, because I wanted to make sure she was a good driver. You know what happened about 3 weeks after she began to drive the car? She got in one night and it was dark. She said, "Daddy, there's something on the back of the car you want to see." So I walked out there, and she was right. It was dented. My car was dented, and I got hot. See, I didn't like that. And I said, "I can't believe you've done this. I tell you this. You told me, you know." I went on and on, except I didn't do it in front of her. I had to do that privately because I didn't want to set the wrong example. But she promised me. But I've been there now, and I've done that. So when my stepdaughter wanted the car, having been there and done that, I gave a little lecture. Betsy and I got to give a little lecture. Now, you think things won't happen. You young people in this audience, you're going to tell me it will not happen. Mom and Dad, ignore the preacher today because he's just putting propaganda out. We've been there and we've done that. Let me tell you what happened. You think it won't happen? Wait a minute. We got her a little car. Now, what kind of a car do kids want? Oh, you've been there and you've done that. And is it automatic or is it stick shift? Oh, no, it has to be stick shift in Texas. Oh, yeah, in Texas. I mean, it's not cool to just clunk and drive along. You got to, you know, you got to be going down the highway like this. See, that's cool. So anyway, here it is. And guess where this accident took place? In my driveway. See, she was in a hurry to go to school, and her car was parked in front of another young man's car who was over visiting, and she got out, and she put it in reverse. And guess what was back there? Yeah. So, guess how much damage? I think Betsy told me yesterday we had to pay $400 cash out of our pocket. So, any of you young people who want to talk to me about not having an accident, I've been there, and I've done that. Now, it's not going to fly with me. All right. And listen to your mom and your dad when they talk to you about insurance rates and other things like that. He goes on to say in verse 9, he says, "So I was great," this is what the outcome of it was, "and increased more than all that were before me in Jerusalem. Also my eye remained with me," or my wisdom remained with me. "And whatsoever mine eyes desired, I kept not from them. I withheld not my heart from any joy, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor, and all this was my portion of all my labor. Then I looked on all the work that my hands had wrought, and on the labor that I had labored to do, and behold," guess what? "I've been there and I've done that. All was vanity and vexation of the spirit. There was no profit." Where? There's that expression again. Under the sun. Okay. Why is it that he tells us these things? You do get a sense of frustration. It does make a difference about your houses, about your fountains, about your cars. It's an interesting thing, like we already discussed. If you got a one-bedroom house, you want a two-bedroom home. You want a bigger home, you want a bigger home. Why is that? Because the eye never gets satisfied, the ear never gets enough, does it? There's a law that I want to share with you just ever so quickly. And remember this law, because it comes to play in our lives constantly. It even happens at the Feast of Tabernacles. It happens at home. It happens at your work. It happens everywhere. It's the law of diminishing return. Are you familiar with that law? You know what it's all about? The law of diminishing return. What that means is, I'll illustrate it with something that I learned about up in Canada when I was up there briefly, with the wonderful people up in Canada. A man came up to me who I respected highly, and he said, I said, what'd you do yesterday? And he said, well, we went horseback riding. I said, oh, did you enjoy it? He said, no. This was the second time to go. And I knew why he didn't enjoy it. I knew why. The law of diminishing return got him. Because you see, he went for his first time last year. Last year he liked it. What changed? The law, he'd already done it. The law of diminishing return comes to play here. What it means is you expend X amount of energy, so much energy, and it creates a certain result. And it creates what is called a rush. Do you know what I mean by a rush? A feeling, an emotion, a sensation, satisfaction. But the next time you do it, guess what you have to do to get that same feeling and same satisfaction? You have to do more. You have to do more. And you have to do more. See, this is what was wrong with this gentleman. See, last year when he got on the horse, this horse, and he was so excited about it. Oh, he'd never been on a horse before. He's going to ride along. And it was just like all horses that you ride for the first time. It goes top speed about a half a mile an hour. Boom, and he's, boom. Boy, this is great. Oh, man, I've never done this. John Wayne. Okay, God, oh, this is great. He had a great time. Now, this year, it's changed. Horse hasn't changed. Place hasn't changed. He's changed. He expended that same amount of energy. It didn't satisfy him. You know what he wants now? A fast horse. You got to have a fast horse. I mean, one that you can just rein and, you know, you can jerk him over here and you can jerk him over here and he'll jump over things and all this kind of thing. You know what happens, though, eventually with that? You do that, then what? Well, yeah, you fall and break your neck. I mean, I've done that. I've been there and I've done that because I have, you know, I'm talking about myself as well in this because I was much the same way. I wanted a horse that was fast. So I got him finally one day. I mean, one of the fastest horses. This is in Big Sandy in the campus there. And I got that horse and it was raining and we went around. I mean, we jerked around and we were all racing along there. And man, I was John Wayne. Guess what? The horse fell over on me. So I've been there and I've done that. Now you know what? I don't even get near horses. I've had enough horses. Because the amount of energy, I don't know where it goes from here. So this is the thing that bothers me. Now, I want to give you one other illustration. I'll try to get off of this, but I hope you get my point. The law of diminishing return. Because you see, it applies even at the Feast of Tabernacles. I remember my very first Feast of Tabernacles when I slept on a picnic table. Now, would I sleep on a picnic table? Why not? Huh? I've been there and I've done that. But the point of the matter is to do that now doesn't create the same degree of satisfaction. That's the reason why we get up. Mr. Garner gets all these complaints about buildings and where they're staying and the beds aren't comfortable and all that because the law of diminishing return is at motion here. So used to, X amount of dollars would buy this room. I remember years and years ago, a family on the way to Jekyll Island, a man who could afford a lot. He didn't have a lot to stay. I mean, he didn't have a good place reserved, so he just sort of checked into a place. And when he was in there, he peeled back the covers, and the roaches had bred between the covers in this little small room. Little bitty bugs. Millions of them, he said. I was always fascinated about whether or not he slept there that night. But the point is that he didn't really complain. I remember that. Okay. Now, I'm not suggesting, by the way, that you sleep in a bed like that. That's not what I'm implying. But some another, it didn't make all that much difference back then because the law of diminishing return had not set in. It also applies to other aspects of life. An area that's frustrating to me is I do like to try to play sports. Any of you like to play sports? Sure you do in here. There's a law of diminishing return going on physically in our bodies. But I remember years ago, I thought, okay, I'm going to learn how to play racquetball. Any of you know how to play racquetball? Racquetball is a fun game. A little racquet with the ball. I didn't know how to do it. I got out there, and I mean, just with this a little bit of effort, I had so much fun. I mean, it was so much fun. I'd hit that ball. Oh, this is great. I'd laugh. Oh, yeah, let's do it again. Yeah, I got killed. He beat me 21-3. Oh, I had fun. I'm learning. And now, to get that same satisfaction, guess what I'm having to do? Put more and more energy into it. And naturally, then, I'm getting a little bit better as we go along. And finally, it got to the point, this is what happened one day. I was playing in some tournament play. And have you ever seen these athletes get themselves psyched up? Have you ever seen that? And I was just standing there. I mean, I just had my little old trunks on and my shoes on, a little old shirt. Didn't have a big, you know, nothing special about it. He comes in there. I'm sitting there. And I was supposed to be the one to beat. And he completely intimidated me. And because, you know, teaching of the church, every time I made it a point, sometimes when the guy would make a good shot, I would say, "Nice shot. That's a good shot." And he was, and he just growled. You think I'm exaggerating? I sat there and I thought, this is incredible. And he said, "That's not a good shot." So I just shut up. And when I would make a good shot, which wasn't very often that evening, he wouldn't even look at me. And I decided then to quit. And I quit. You know why? It wasn't fun anymore. It wasn't fun. I was expending all this energy, and it wasn't there anymore. When people treat you that way, I'm through. And so I've quit racquetball. I haven't played. It's been many, many years now since I played racquetball. Doesn't mean I wouldn't do it again. I might. But I'm going to do it for a different reason now. See, I've been there and I've done that. Solomon would tell me, "Listen, Charles, you should listen to me a long time ago. I've been there and I've done that. I've had the chariots. I've had the horses. Why didn't you listen to me? We'd had racquetball back there. I'd have beat your brains out." That's how good he would have been. "I've been there and I've done that." No, we don't listen. Now, I want you to see with me something over in the book of Colossians, because I want to take a quantum leap right now with you, and I want you to go with me to where we're directed to go in Colossians. Colossians chapter 3. "If you be been risen with Christ," or "be with Christ, seek those things which are" where? Tell me where they are. They're above what? The sun. He says then, "Where Christ sits on the right hand of God, set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth." Because houses and plants and trees and cars and racquetball and all that stuff is what? It's useless. It's temporary. I mean, I know we've got to be, you know, I know what Solomon says about taking care and laboring under the sun and being satisfied by that. Yeah, we do want to take care of our homes. We do want to take care of our trees. I know that. But that's not where it is. See, another little thing which I learned, I love to deer hunt. See, and I used to, you know what I used to deer hunt for? A rack. You know what I deer hunt for now? Just to be there. See, I've finally gone full course now, and now I know what I really enjoy about it. I just enjoy being there. So we're supposed to live above the sun. "Why? For you are dead, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is our life, shall appear, then shall you also appear with him in glory." So it tells us how to live above the sun. It's very simple. It's very clear. These verses are not easily misunderstood. It says to mortify, therefore, your members which are upon the earth. Stop living under the sun. That's not our focus. I mean, we have to live here, but we're living for something else. And it says to mortify fornication and uncleanness and inordinate affection. List all these types of things. I read a very moving illustration the other day of a man. You see, ladies, you got to understand something. The book of 1 Corinthians is exactly right. You know, all the things that are in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 about husbands and wives' relationships are right on. This man was faithful to his wife, but he was like all of us. He wanted to do a little bit of living under the sun. So what he decided to do is, he was in an overseas country, and he thought, and he loved his wife. He said, "My wife will never find out. She'll never know. I wonder what it's like to be unfaithful." And really what he was doing, he was responding to his lust. That's what he was doing. And he happened to be, I think it was second or third up, and he looked over into a river, and he looked out there, and here was a lady bathing over there. And apparently she was not clad from the top up, and although her back was to him. And he thought, "Oh, should I or shouldn't I? Should I or shouldn't I? No one will know. My wife will never find out." So you know what he did? He changed clothes, got in a swimsuit, jumped into the river, swam over there, and came up close to her. And when he did, he startled her a little bit. And she turned around to look at him, and she was a leper with no nose and her ears off. And you know what he said? He said, "Oh, wretched man that I am." And he was. And he stopped. Sometimes it takes that to get us above the sun. Because if you want to have misery in your life, be unfaithful. That's living under the sun. The Bible tells us that. Don't do it. Stop that. Mortify it. Fornication, uncleanness, inordinate affection, evil concupiscence, and covetousness, which is idolatry, which for which thing's sake the wrath of God comes on the children of disobedience, in the which you also walked sometime when you lived in them, but now you also put off all of these, and it tells all these things that we put off. And you put on the new man, which is renewed in knowledge after the image of him that created him. So in verse 12 it says, so then put on all these things, the elect of God, these mercies and these kindnesses and these humbleness of minds and all these kinds of things. You know, we're called to live above the sun. It's a real challenge. Now, this day is the last great day, is it not? Do you remember that? This is the last great day. I want you to see the witness that is given over in John chapter 7. Jesus Christ himself, in testimony, tells us what's important on this day. Those of you who want to live above the sun, let's listen to the testimony of our Savior, Jesus Christ, in John chapter 7, over in verse 37. Not a whole lot here, but my, what a message. Who's this day for? This last great day of God's holy plan? You could turn back to Revelation chapter 20 if you wanted to. We won't turn there and read it. It's for those that are dead, the small, and the great, who have never, ever had the opportunity to live above the sun because they were never converted. They'd never been given God's Holy Spirit. They died in fornication. They died in sin and iniquity. They died in disobedience. And so they're in their grave, and they're awaiting this day. Notice what Jesus said here. In the last day, that great day of the feast, Jesus stood up and cried, very simply saying, if any man thirst, any man, not just the ones we like, any man or woman thirst, what are they supposed to do? Let him come unto me and be filled and drink. And be satisfied, he says. Do you know what it's like to live above the sun? You do. Let me give you a few little illustrations of this. I'm reminded of a story. I don't know how old the young lady was, but she was pretty ill. She was taken to the hospital by a minister. And along with the minister, bringing this, I think about pre-teenage girl, was the mother, and also the mother had a seven-month-old child. They come into the hospital, and what makes this story unique is that this girl had lived 10 miles from anywhere. I mean, we're talking about back hill country. And she had been born with a bladder outside of her body. That's how she had lived all these years. And, of course, part of that is, you know, her parents wouldn't expose her to the public. As a matter of fact, she had never, ever, ever ridden in a car. She had never ridden in a truck. She had never ridden in a train. She had never been to town. All of a sudden, she's in town. The newspaper people got a hold of it and followed the story and printed a story about this young lady. I'm talking about living above the sun, folks. They printed the story, and someone down in Atlanta, Georgia, who happened to be involved with his title was, but he was involved in trains and he could make decisions. And there were two trains out of Atlanta, one to Savannah, one to Columbus. He happened to offer this young lady a free ride on the one that went to Columbus, Georgia. And they took him up on it. It only took about 2 or 3 hours, and then they'd be able to get back to the hospital. She had never done anything like this. In fact, she was afraid to ride on a truck because she had seen it from a distance one time and sort of giggled about it. She said, I don't want to do that because it makes you jiggle. She didn't know what to do with that. So here she is on this train, and she's into the dining car. She'd never been in a dining car before. And she looked in there, and here's all the white tablecloths and all the silverware. And that was over her head. She didn't know what to do. And everybody was sort of watching her, and the dining car was filled with people. And the porter came out, or the waiter came out, and he served her a bowl of soup. Guess what she did with it? That's right. Before anybody knew what would happen, she did the only thing that came natural. She just reached down here and slurped that soup up. Right? Okay, now if you live under the sun, what do you think about that? You'd say, That's what kids would do. Isn't that? She doesn't know what's wrong with her. Now, if you want to live above the sun, what do? I'll tell you what you do. You do what everybody in that car did that day. Because the guy who was serving, he almost broke out in a smile, but when he did, he looked at the guy who was sponsoring the train tour, and there was a frown on his face, and so the guy who was in charge, he took his bowl of soup, and he dumped his the same way. And then everybody looked around the train, and all the patrons on the dining car, guess what they were doing? They all took their soup and went... Now, I'm not advocating you eat that way. I'm just saying that that particular situation called for a choice. And maybe the choice of making that young lady with a bladder hanging outside of her body, who had never been in a train ever once in her life, making her comfortable might be more important than teaching her to use a spoon at that moment. Do you think? One other example. Kids will love this one. I'd like to tell you about a young girl named Stephanie. She was in high school, about 16 years of age. They had a rule at school. Guess what the rule was? The rule was that if you don't phone in by 2 o'clock, you have to go to detention. Well, the young lady wasn't feeling well that morning, so she asked her mother, Susan, to phone in for her. Her mother was 34 years of age, a businesswoman. She got busy. She forgot. Guess what happened? Her daughter said, Mom, did you phone in? Oh, no, I forgot. She said, I'll go to detention. So the mother called up and she said, listen, I called in, but it was at 2:30. The principal was adamant. He said, no, rules are rules. She's got to go to detention. And the teacher said, now, wait a minute. We get a chance here to live above the sun or below the sun. If we're going to live below the sun, what do we do? Huh? Oh, we throw a temper tantrum. We get upset. Don't you do that. That's not fair. And as the principal said, the most frequent comment that was ever called in, you're not going to punish my child. All right, now I like what this mother did. She lived above the sun for a few moments. She thought, now she asked the principal, she said, now what's the reason for this? And he said, because to teach the children to be responsible. She said, but it was my mistake. Well, if it's my mistake, then I'm going to be responsible. So I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to detention in the place of my daughter. You are? And she did. She went to school, took 2 days out of her schedule, went in there and sat in a little desk, you know how those desks are, all crowded up from 8 to 3. Had to sit there and even had to ask for permission to go to the bathroom. Now, what do you think her daughter thought of this? Her daughter said, boy, I'll tell you one thing. Throughout my whole life, my mother's done a lot of neat things, but this is the neatest. See? Living above the sun. You can come up with illustrations like that. I mean, every aspect of life, we get a chance to live above the sun or below the sun. And a lot of it depends upon our focus in life, where we're going, what we're determined to do. Jesus said that any man who comes to me, let him come unto me and drink. Now, recently, just before the feast, Betsy and I did something that was very meaningful to me. We went up to our family cemetery. Do any of you have family cemeteries? Can I see your hands? Good. I went to the family cemetery. I took Betsy with me. It was real sobering because here's two rows, not a very large cemetery, two rows of headstones. And Betsy and I walked through those things. We looked at all the little things written on those tombstones. And then my father was with me, so I had a chance to talk to him. He told me where he was going to be buried, and Betsy got to talking about where we were going to be buried. You know, it's pretty sobering to look at where you're going to be buried. It really is. It's pretty sobering. And I looked over there and I thought, okay, and my dad was telling me a tradition in Tennessee is that you don't bury someone with their head down. Is that true? I guess you don't do that. And you don't bury anyone with their head to the west. See, apparently you don't. Not in my part of the country. So he said that when he was going to be buried, he'd be facing that way. And I was sitting there, well, it doesn't make a difference to me, just as long as, you know, I'm deep enough not to be chewed up by rodents. I don't really care. But I walked away from there and I got to looking at all those tombstones. I only knew one person in the entire graveyard. That was my grandmother. I only knew her. And there's a chance that she might come up in the first resurrection, most likely the second. I just don't know how God's going to look at those things. That's up to Him. But I was thinking about something that... resurrection or the great white throne judgment. I don't know his name. I'm sorry. I don't know his name. But I know about him. His title is John Doe number 24.
That was his title. Let me tell you a little bit about him. He was found up in a town of Illinois wandering around one day as a teenager. As he was wandering around, no one was with him, and so he was just picked up. There was something unusual about him. He could not see, he could not hear, and he could not speak. He was just aimlessly wandering around. So they took him to the mental health institution, and he was the 24th person to be brought in who did not have a name. So he was John Doe number 24. He lived there until about 64. And during that course of time, he never spoke, he never wrote, but he lived. They took care of him. When he died at age 64, there was lots of conversation about it, and even at the graveside, questions were asked about, well, tell me what you know about him. And one of his co-workers who worked with him said, well, you know, in the later years I worked with him, he probably was a lot like my grandfather because there were little clues in his life. We could never reach him. We could never get him to talk, but there were little clues. The one name he would attempt to scrawl out occasionally was Lewis. He tried to scrawl out Lewis. He just tried to scrawl it out. It looked like Lewis. The other thing that he would do is he would pantomime. You know how people pantomime? And he would, almost like he was marching. And so they wondered, was it because he had gone to be a part of a marching band at some time, or just what it was. And they also noticed that he had an aptitude for jazz music. So they didn't know what quite to think about that. And what's sad about this story to me is that when he died, someone who was there said, does anybody have any words to say? Not one person had anything to say. Not one person. What do you say about a life that no one knows anything about? They buried him. John Doe, number 24. You know, it's not true that no one knew his name. Is it? It's not true. Someone knew his name, and that was whom? That's who? That was God. God knows his name. And one of these days, if you wanted to go back in the gospel account and read about Lazarus, a name will be called not by a man, because a man can't call a man out of the grave. It takes God to do it. And when God says, Tim, John, Tom, Charles, Nancy, whatever, come out, guess what's going to happen? They're going to get to live above the sun for a while. You see, he's in the tomb, and he's waiting that voice to call out, come and live. Now, when that happens, I want you to look at something that I hope you and I will have a part in. Notice that with me very quickly. It's over in the book of Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 30. And I tried to wonder about this and envision it. What an exciting moment this might be. Isaiah chapter 30. Just a couple of verses. It says here, beginning in verse 19 of Isaiah chapter 30, for the people shall dwell in Zion at Jerusalem. And it says, you're not going to weep anymore. He will be very gracious unto you at the voice of your cry. When he shall hear it, he will answer you. And though the Lord give you the bread of affliction or adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not your teachers be removed into a corner anymore, but your eyes shall see your teachers. And your ears shall hear a word behind you saying, what? This is the way, walk you in it. When you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left, the voices are going to say, now this is the way, walk you in it. And who is that going to be? Us. Now, I look at this a little bit different. I love that verse right there. But what I want to do, when John Doe number 24 comes out, or whoever it is, I can just see Christ calling him out of there at the resurrection in Mass. He comes out, and he doesn't know what to do, and he says, here, Charles, you take care of him. Oh, okay, I'll be happy to do that. And so here John Doe number 24 gets up there, and he goes off to the right. What am I going to say? I've been there, and I've done that. Don't you do that. Uh-uh. No, listen to me. I've been there, and I've done that. So he goes off to the left. You know what I'm going to say? I've been there and I've done that. This is the way. Walk you in it. Now that's what Christ could tell us too, because there's not one temptation common among men that who has not experienced? Jesus Christ. He's been there. He's done that. Okay. Ecclesiastes then. Chapter 9. Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Verses to live by. Verses to go home with. Verses to live above the sun with. One difficult thing about the Feast of Tabernacles is going home. It's saying goodbye. It'll be a long time before we see each other again. I've learned something this year. See, I don't just mean to be up here telling you things that I don't feel. That shouldn't be said by a minister. It should be obvious. But you know, a lot of people put stock in education, and there's nothing wrong with education, but I mean, you know, all the credentials and all that kind of thing. And those things are okay, but that's not where it is. I'll tell you where. I can prove that to you real quickly. You think it's in education and fame and money and prestige? Let me prove it to you real quickly. Name the last five Pulitzer Prize winners. That's the best you can get. Name them. Can you name two of them, three of them, four? No, you can't. All right, name five... Five of the wealthiest men in the world. Okay, everybody gets Gates because he's been in the news. You might get two or three. You're doing better. Okay. Name me the last five best motion pictures in America. You'll even do better on that one. We'll struggle with it though. Now, let me change it just a little bit. Name for me five people who you know love you. Can you list them for me? Name for me five people that if you are in the hospital sick, you know will come and visit you. Can you bear me their names? And in that breath, I'd like to say thank you to all of you who had a part in me not dying recently. See, what I've learned in all this is, you know what matters? That people care. Because back in January, when I couldn't decide for myself because I was dead in all intents and purposes, you know, they cut you open and they put you on this machine, and the machine's running your heart and the machine's running your lungs, and you don't even know what's going on, and you're in total blackness, and you come back out of here, and I remember, and Betsy was by me the whole time, you know. And I remember when I woke up, I thought, such blackness. No, I didn't see an angel. I missed that. No bright light either. I don't know. Uh-oh. I've been there and I've done that now. And I don't want to do it again. But let me say to all of you, when, you know, there's a point of vulnerability there, if I may tell you in all honesty. A point of vulnerability. You're there. You're treated like they have to treat you. And all that's really between you and life and death is what? Prayers. Because the person next door to where I was died. Right next door, Betsy talked to the family. The person right next door to me died. That sobered me up. And I knew, and I am thankful for, and I want to say thank you to all of you that knew me well enough, or maybe you didn't even know me well enough, but you took time to get on your knees and to do something that's living above the sun. And that is, you prayed for me. It works. Thank you all very much for that. Now, if I'm sick again, do it again. Prayer is living above the sun, isn't it? Oh, yeah, it is. Okay, it's time to go. Verse 7 says of Ecclesiastes chapter 9, go your way, brethren. Eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God now accepts your works. Let your garments be always white, and let your head lack no ointment. Do this, live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of the life of your vanity, which he has given you under the sun,
all the days of your vanity, he says. For that is your portion in this life and in your labor which you take under the sun. So whatsoever your hand finds to do, you do it with all of your might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave where you go, and where there are countless millions whose names we do not know, who are awaiting the fulfillment of this great last day witness and message from Christ, that if any man thirst, let him come to me, come out of the grave, come out of the tomb. And we hope to be there. We really do. We hope to be there. So I want to tell you how you're going to get there. You're not going to get there by living under the sun. Solomon would tell you, I've been there and I've done that. That doesn't work. You want to make it into the kingdom of God? You want to help be a part of calling human beings out of the grave and watching them come out in bewilderment and showing them the way to live life? And I'll tell you how to get there. That is, live above the sun. And I'll tell you something about the view above the sun. It's incredible. It's beautiful. It's satisfying. I'll tell you something. We got something ahead of us. We got to go there, and we got to do that. Don't we? So we'll be there and do that. Let's live above the sun. Man, what a view.